This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have a few stories today about America and its place in the world. In our second segment, we'll hear a report from trumpet writer Richard Palmer about how control of the world's oceans is transferring from the United States over to a new rising maritime power, China. He's going to show the importance of sea gates to national power and how China is establishing its presence in more and more of these gates around the world as America pulls back. We'll also hear a report from trumpet writer Andrew Miller about America's declining merchant marine fleet. The number of merchant vessels from the U.S. has been declining for some years, and it may leave the United States unable to supply and sustain a long-distance war. So quite a bit of bad news there, but I'll conclude today's show by talking about how America's and Britain's greatest days lie yet ahead. We're going to start the program, though, by talking about this remarkable statement last week from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
We're not going to make America great again. It was never that great.
He said that at a bill signing event in Manhattan last Wednesday, of course, referring to Donald Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again. He says America was never that great. And you can hear the crowd reacting to that statement. Governor Cuomo went on to say this.
We have not reached greatness. We will reach greatness when every American is fully engaged. We will reach greatness when discrimination and stereotyping against women, 51% of our population, is gone, and every woman's full potential is realized and unleashed, and every woman is making her full contribution. When that happens, this nation is going to be taken even higher. Because we have not yet fully liberated the women in this country. And we will.
Governor Cuomo took a lot of heat for that remark, and he immediately had to try to explain what he meant, how it was misinterpreted. His press secretary said the governor believes America is great and that her full greatness will be fully realized when every man, woman, and child has full equality. He said that when President Trump says, make America great again, he's really saying that the president wants to take America back to when there was slavery, discrimination, segregation, sexism, and marginalized women's contributions, which is ridiculous. But there is a fundamental issue here that we need to understand clearly regarding how we look at the world. What Governor Cuomo said wasn't just a clumsy statement. This represents a core perspective of the left in America, in academia, more and more of the media, the Democrat Party, a great deal of the political class. You might remember last September during a campaign rally for Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, a reporter referenced that Make America Great Again slogan, and he asked Roy Moore, when was America last great? And when Moore pointed back to the time before the Civil War, he said, even though we had slavery, our families were strong, our country had a direction. Well, all the press, the politicians jumped all over him and accused him of believing that slavery made America great. And Roy Moore supports slavery. So the question is, what would have been an appropriate answer to that question in their minds? If you believe America was great when it permitted slavery, then you advocate slavery. You're irredeemably racist. If you believe America was great before it gave women the vote, well, you believe women should be stripped of the right to vote. Seems to be the logic at play here. And people criticized Andrew Cuomo for saying it the way that he did, but I think his statement actually articulates what, in their mind, the eyes of the left, is an appropriate answer to that question. When was America great? Well, it was never that great. In their view, America was immoral from its foundation because of those sins. As Cuomo's press secretary put it, slavery, discrimination, segregation, sexism, marginalized women's contributions. Now, of course, the left would never say that same thing about other nations. They'd never say that Saudi Arabia isn't great, where women just gained the right to drive a car just a few months ago, or Afghanistan, where a woman would risk being beaten or killed if she appeared in public without wearing a burqa from head to toe. But measuring national greatness according to when, as Governor Cuomo put it, every woman's full potential is realized and unleashed, and every woman is making her full contribution, it's a very unusual measure of national greatness. By that measure, no nation in history has ever been great. It's an impossible standard. I would say it's a perverse standard. And the reason is, I'm sure he's talking about realizing every woman's full potential in the workplace, that every woman is making her full contribution out in society. And by that measure, a homemaker isn't realizing her full potential. She's not making her full contribution. So we have more work to do before society will be great. But did you know that God himself says America was great? I can show you this in the Bible. The Trumpet's regular listeners and readers are well aware of Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States in Britain in Prophecy. And this book explains America's origins back in the Bible. He traces the history of our people back to Britain, and before that to Europe and captivity to European peoples. And he shows how they are actually descended from the biblical nation of Israel. People think of the Jews as Israel, but the Jews are descended from the tribe of Judah. The so-called lost 10 tribes of Israel include many peoples on earth today. They were taken, you can look in the Bible, they were taken into captivity by the Assyrians. And then in that captivity, they later migrated to Britain and to America. You can trace that history all the way back to Abraham, the father of the nations of Israel, and to promises that God himself made to this great patriarch and to his son and grandson and great-grandson. The very first promise God made to Abraham, you can find in the first few verses of Genesis 12. God said, "Get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation." A great nation. And you study the book of Genesis and you see that promise repeated several times and refined and emphasized. God said that several nations would descend from Abraham. He said that some of those nations would come to possess the world's sea gates, even those of their enemies and those that hated them. He said that they would inhabit the richest parts of the earth, that they would be tremendously wealthy and powerful, that they would spread abroad, north, south, east, and west, that other nations would serve them, and that these nations would actually be a benefit to other nations. And God specifically promised that two particularly powerful nations would descend from Abraham's great-grandsons, Manasseh and Ephraim. He said they would be a nation and a company of nations. And Mr. Armstrong proves in The United States and Britain in Prophecy that this is referring to America and Britain. No other nations on earth have ever fulfilled these prophecies, these promises. There's a tremendous amount of proof in this book about that fact. But even if you just read the descriptions in Genesis and you look at the world in the past 200 years, you'd have to conclude that only America and Britain have fulfilled those promises. America was great. And in many ways, it still is great, stunningly great, because God made it great in order to fulfill his promises to Abraham and his descendants. I will make of you a great nation. America has been the single greatest nation in history by virtually every measure. Geographical advantages, wealth, economic opportunity, universal prosperity, individual liberty, social equality and opportunity, industrial capacity, technological innovation, military might, generosity to other nations, many, many, many factors. And only a deluded liberal would try to refute that. These are the factors by which God and all history measure greatness, not whether every woman is making her full contribution. And you can see in Genesis 48, God prophesied that Britain would be even greater. And you look at the British Empire at its peak, and it was even more influential, even more impressive by comparison. And yet the British Empire is probably even more despised than America is by liberals. Last week, we started our new year of Herbert W. Armstrong College. We held a reception for the incoming freshmen. Each year, we have the freshmen introduce themselves to the student body and the faculty, just tell a little bit about themselves and their goals for the coming year. One of our freshmen this year is from Zimbabwe. He's 20 years old. His name is Rufaro Manyepa. And I want to play a clip of part of what he said at the freshman reception.
Coming here to the United States for the first time in my life, I've just seen firsthand the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. And the United States is just the most blessed nation in the world ever. And seeing that, especially from where I come from, it's had a really big impact on me.
How refreshing to hear that. What sort of measure are you using when you look at the world, when you look at other people, when you look at history? Isn't it remarkable that God could bless America with unparalleled blessings of every type, that he could lift this nation to the very pinnacle of greatness, and people could reason their way into looking at this nation and its miraculous history and say it was never that great?
We're not going to make America great again. It was never that great.
Have you ever given your child a great, precious gift and had them treat it with such contempt and disdain and arrogance as people in America today are treating what God has given to us? What sort of measure are you using? Do you see things the way God does? When God calls something great, or when God makes something great, can you recognize that? Or, you know, are you like so many people today who look at it through a distorted lens and just see imperfections and flaws? Maybe you remember in the Bible the example of Mary of Bethany. There was an instance recorded in the Gospels where this woman anointed Christ's feet with oil and she wiped it with her hair. It was just an extraordinary act. She was showing the Son of God incredible honor, and Jesus Christ praised her highly for that. Well, then Christ's disciple Judas watched this moving display of love for God, and he was outraged. He said, well, you should have sold that ointment and given the money to the poor. You know, this is supposed to be a religion of love. We're supposed to look after poor people, and this is just excess and luxury and materialism. We shouldn't be wasting resources on something like this. And it records in John 12, it exposes the fact that Judas wasn't interested in the poor. He was a thief. He wanted money for himself, but he dressed his argument up in a cloak of righteousness. He was inspired by the devil. It is the devil who is so full of self-righteousness that he's always looking down at people and criticizing and condemning. And here the devil was actually trying to expose the supposed hypocrisy in what Christ himself was doing. In his mind, he's got it all reasoned out that God is a hypocrite, God is unjust, I'm right. The Pharisees looked at the only man in history who kept God's law perfectly. He was standing right before their eyes. And what did they see? They saw a glutton, a winebibber, a friend of publicans and sinners. They condemned him. The left in America today views anyone who falls afoul of their rules as irredeemable. You remember probably back in 2016, Hillary Clinton said this at an LGBT gala in New York.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. Now, some of those folks, they are irredeemable, but thankfully they are not America.
The left loves to condemn and exalt itself and to extol its own supposed moral perfection. Even looking at the history of America and looking at the founding fathers, they see only sinners, slaveholders, barbarians. It says in Jeremiah 17, verses 5 and 6, "Thus says the Eternal, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from the Eternal. For he shall be like the heath in the desert, like a small shrub in the desert, and shall not see when good comes, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness, in a salt land and not inhabited." The man who trusts in man cannot see when good comes. He has his blinders on. His perspective is limited and narrow and negative, just like the devil. And God says it's like he's living in a dry, parched desert spiritually. He could even be living in the most blessed nation in all of history and say, well, it was never that great. But notice the contrast. In verses 7 and 8, it says, "Blessed is the man that trusts in the Eternal and whose hope the Eternal is. For he shall be as a tree planted by the waters and that spreads out her root by the river and shall not see when heat comes. But her leaf shall be green and shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit." What a contrast! This tree that is just beautiful and rich and producing fruit. If you trust God, you're going to be soaking up the living waters of that river and bearing green leaves. And why? Because you're thinking like God. You trust yourself, you think like the devil, and you can't see when good comes. You trust God and you think like God, you won't even see when the heat comes. And even in a drought, in difficult circumstances, you'll still bear rich fruit. It's just a beautiful picture of the vast difference between thinking like the devil and thinking like God. The devil can look at Christ himself and see a hypocrite and a failure. God can look at a sinner and he can see a perfect heart. He can see a future king and a priest. Verse 9 there in Jeremiah 17 says that our human hearts are black and ugly. And that's something that we have to recognize and see plainly the way God does. But when we recognize that and repent of it, God says he will heal that and he'll put a new, clean heart in us. The Bible gives histories of God's greatest servants, and God took pains to record not just their virtues, but even their sins and their faults, of Abraham and Moses and David and Elijah. And he didn't record those things to put those men down. He did that to show us that this is how an evil human heart can be transformed. There were plenty of faults and problems. And when Satan looked at those men, he saw weakness and incompetence. Satan did everything that he could to pick those men apart. But when God looked at those men, the Bible tells us he saw perfection. He saw a friend. He saw a heart like his own heart. Thank God he's so patient and positive with us. Thank God that his correction is tempered with mercy. I mean, that is something to praise God for and then follow that example. What happens when we come to look at the greatness with which God blessed America with hatred and contempt? Thomas Jefferson said, "Now a government is like everything else. To preserve it, we must love it. Everything, therefore, depends on establishing this love in a republic, and to inspire it ought to be the principal business of education." I'm reading the Churchill biography by William Manchester, The Last Lion, and he talks about at the height of the British Empire, how the young people in that empire were raised on tales of heroism and sacrifice. They were raised to love the empire and do everything they could for the empire. And when the people were behind it, the empire flourished. When they believed in it, it expanded, it thrived. And at one time, America had a similar belief in the ideals that built this nation. But today, enlightened thinking, quote-unquote enlightened, says America was never that great. It's swayed by that negative spiritual influence. And a great many people now are looking at the greatest nation in history, and they see nothing but a hotbed of discrimination and barbaric thinking and behavior. And because of that, they are ripping this once blessed nation apart. They look at this nation the way that America's worst enemies look at this nation. And they're doing the work of those enemies and the work of the devil himself. If you want to know more about what's happening in this nation and what prophecy says will happen, you should read Gerald Flory's booklet, Great Again. This booklet, it not only shows why America has lost a lot of the greatness that it once had, but also how God has promised to once again restore this nation to become even greater than it has ever been.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
One major blessing that God has given America is its naval power. God specifically promised to give America and Britain control over the world's sea gates. These are critical for economic and military purposes and require considerable military might to defend. Well, control of the world's oceans and sea gates is transferring from the United States to a new maritime power, China, as we will now hear in this report from Richard Palmer.
Money makes the world go round, and today a lot of that money flows through maritime passageways. These small stretches of water can seem remote, uninteresting, academic, something that has nothing to do with our everyday lives. Well, if you thought that way, you couldn't be more wrong. 90% of the world's trade travels by oceans. Here in the UK, 95% of the products that we use come from overseas. There's electronics devices, clothing, raw materials, so many other things. They come to us by ships. And these ships provide almost a literal lifeline to modern nations. Again, here in the UK, most of our food comes from overseas. 60% of the world's oil travels in those massive ocean-going tankers. But most maritime trade travels through narrow waterways that we talk about a fair bit on the Trumpet and generally refer to as sea gates. For example, 1/3 of all ocean-going trade travels through the South China Sea. This area that you see frequently on the news as China stations with more and more weapons and missiles. 35% of all the ocean-going oil in the world travels through the Straits of Hormuz, a waterway controlled by Iran, again, that we see in the news on a weekly, if not daily, basis as Iran conducts drills there and threatens to close it. 1/4 of all ocean-going oil travels through the Straits of Malacca near Singapore. 10% of all that oil goes around the southern tip of Africa. About 15% of all the world's maritime trade travels through the Red Sea. So our everyday lives depend on a constant flow of materials and goods from overseas, and so much of that flow depends on free passage through these very narrow sea gates. Close these gates using warships or mines or shipwrecks or anything, and the oil market will panic, the global economic chaos will break out. Here in the UK, we'd quickly begin to starve. Elizabeth Broer wrote recently in Foreign Policy that disruptions to global supply chains are, in fact, more devastating than a traditional military attack. She talked about how using this means an adversary could bring a country to its knees without dispatching a single soldier. And this is why controlling the world's sea gates and world empire go hand in hand. It's something you see throughout history. Just you go back to the very first truly world-encompassing empires. Like once mariners had sailed around the world and sea trade really began to take off. All of these empires, like the Portuguese Empire, the Dutch Empire, the British Empire, They controlled and fought for control of these sea gates. It's what made these nations empires. It's what made them powers. You look at the history of some of these sea gates and you take Sri Lanka. It was owned by first the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the British. The history of the world is written in the history of these sea gates. That's how important they are. And you look at Sri Lanka today, and it's starting to pass into control of another power. Another power that's rising up and getting control of a huge number of these sea gates. Since 2005, China has invested $15 billion into Sri Lanka. And a lot of that investment has been in the forms of loans. For example, Sri Lanka borrowed $1 billion to improve one of their key ports, Hambantota Port. And it's the headquarters of their navy. And after all of that $1 billion of investment, a major modern port. The trouble is, Sri Lanka couldn't pay the money back. And so in December, China took control of the port. And now China runs it on a 99-year lease. This is something that nations all around the world are becoming very concerned about, because China has been loaning, Sri Lanka's not a one-off. China has been loaning huge amounts of money to these vital sea gates all around the world. Some of them are just small, isolated island nations, but are just excellent locations for maritime bases and projecting power. And China's been loaning them money. Just this week, Tonga came out and warned that they were facing a similar situation, that they'd borrowed a lot of money from China, they couldn't pay it back, and they were worried that they were going to have to give up valuable assets up to China. Others worry that Djibouti could be next. This is a country that sits right on the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, one of the big, vital sea gates of the world. This controls the entrance to the Red Sea. Foreign Policy had an article over the last month where they asked, will Djibouti become the latest country to fall into China's debt trap? And they noted that Djibouti has an unsustainable level of debt, or much if not most of that, to China. It's also the location of China's first overseas military base, and it's the location of America's only permanent military base in Africa, and a key American base on that maritime choke point. And people are starting to get worried that China's price for all of their Djiboutian debt will be for Djibouti to kick the Americans out of the American base and to have China come on and move in there instead. There are other crucial areas in similar predicaments. You've got the Maldives, where people are starting to become worried. You know, they own 3/4 of their foreign debt to China. People are starting to get worried that China may be able to leverage that to get in position there. Vanuatu, China has a huge amount of investment into this small island. You know, they've built the prime minister a new house. They're working on a new official resident for the president, a new finance ministry. They're extending the foreign ministry's building. I mean, they're literally building the physical infrastructure of government. They've loaned them over $100 million to build one of the best wharfs in the region. Australia and New Zealand just exploded in alarm back in April over reports of, quote, preliminary discussions between China and Vanuatu about building a permanent military presence, because Vanuatu sits basically right on the path between Australia and New Zealand and their most important ally, the United States. A base there would be an excellent place to block these two countries having access to the Pacific. Now, we don't know the details of everything that's going on there, but you see China just buying up a huge amount of all of these sea gates. Pakistan gives us a great example of how this could develop. Since about 2011, China poured about $250 million into transforming a fishing village into a deep water port in the port of Gwadar. It's got a huge potential as a deep water port there. They're pouring another $46 billion into Pakistan as part of a project to create the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Well, once the deep water port had opened up, well, Pakistan announced they were going to open up a naval base there. And then they said, of course, Chinese ships are welcome at our naval base anytime. And China kindly donated a couple of warships. And Pakistan even said that Chinese Navy was welcome to base its own ships there. And then in January this year, China made it all official and they announced they would build its second overseas military base in Gwadar. Now, a lot of these projects, take like Sri Lanka that we mentioned, China is expressly forbidden from turning that port they've acquired there into a military base, into militarizing it. But that what happened in Pakistan gives us a glimpse of how that could change. So this is a really important trend that could give China huge leverage in the world. And we've just looked at in the Pacific. They've been taking advantage of the European debt crisis to buy up key ports all around Europe. They've taken advantage of Latin American financial troubles to buy up ports all around Latin America, especially Panama, where they're getting control of just a vital sea gate there. You've got the South China Sea. You've got a whole load of information that's more and more is coming out every day about the rise of the Chinese Navy. So an important subject from that standpoint, but this is also an important subject because of Bible prophecy. This is a dramatic, dramatic fulfillment of Bible prophecy. The Bible has very specific things to say about sea gates. In Genesis chapter 22, for example, God told Abraham that his descendants would possess the gate of his enemies. And he was talking in the context of promising Abraham as many descendants as the stars of heaven. So when we're talking about millions or billions of people, what does a gate mean in this context? Obviously, it's not just a door in a wall. What is a gate for a nation? Well, it's these maritime passageways. It is these sea gates. That's the only thing that could really apply. And you look at history and you see Britain, America, who you can prove in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, they are the descendants of Abraham. And they got control of all of these gates. But the Bible also specifically said that Britain and America would lose them. In Deuteronomy 28, verse 52, God tells them that they will be besieged in all their gates. So an enemy nation would take these gates and shut them. They would lose control of them. That's exactly what we see happening now with China and others getting control of these crucial sea gates. It's something that's a huge danger to these nations and to the world economy because of how much we rely on trade through these gates. But at the same time, it's a dramatic fulfillment of Bible prophecy.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. You know, the prophecies that you were getting into right at the end of the report there, these are really some of the most specific prophecies in the Bible with respect to the United States and Britain. And when you look at just what's happened historically, how they came into possession of all of those gates, and now they're just losing them one after the other after the other. It's quite extraordinary. Maybe you could just elaborate on that prophecy about losing the gates and then what the economic consequences are going to be.
Sure. Well, we already mentioned Deuteronomy 28:52, but that's not the only prophecy that talks about this. There's a lot of references in the Bible to modern Israel being besieged. So to them being cut off in these sea gates, to them or at least them unable to trade economically, being cut off from the outside world. Mm-hmm. And these sea gates are just the simplest and the easiest way to do that. So, for example, Ezekiel chapter 5 and chapter 6 talk about a violent siege where America is just cut off and Britain from outside resources. And it's something that's devastating to the nation.
So watching what China is doing in light of those prophecies, obviously it takes on a lot more urgency and it's a lot more important than what people would typically look at. Those Bible prophecies really help us to understand just where this is leading. Another prophecy that comes to mind is the fact that it would be China among a group of nations that would actually unify together in order to put that besiegement against the United States.
That's right. Isaiah chapter 23 talks about a maritime alliance. It's about exactly what this article is about. It talks about people crossing oceans, crossing seas, merchants. It's talking about Kittim, which is the biblical name for China. It also talks about Tyre, which refers to this modern European power.
in Bible prophecy, and it talks about these powers forming a mart of nations. So there's this trading alliance. So you put this that describes kind of almost all of the rest of the world, there's a few other nations mentioned in there, having a big trading alliance alongside these other prophecies that talk about Britain and America being cut off economically. Mm-hmm. And so you get this picture of this trading alliance that includes Britain and America and that cuts off these other nations. And then you put those together, and that's exactly what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has done in booklets like Isaiah's End Time Vision. And in that book, he wrote, consider that China now possesses most of the world's strategic sea gates at one time held by Britain and America. The German-led Holy Roman Empire will need to form a brief alliance with the Asian powers identified in Isaiah chapter 23. So you start to put together the trading links that Europe has, and they have a lot of trading links in Africa, a lot especially within Latin America, and they're growing to the sea gates with that China controls, and you have something that has real potential to dominate world trade.
You know, the looking at the way that China is conducting its business, it's really easy to see how they have this forward-looking perspective. They're playing the long game, and they're positioning themselves in these ways that are positioning the nation to really play a major role economically in the future, at the same time that the nations that possess these, the United States and Britain, have lost that kind of perspective and have a much shorter-term view, and there's just a certain level of like a cavalier kind of attitude about just how their power is going to keep on going on despite losing these crucial pillars that gave them the power that they had. You look at it in the perspective of biblical prophecy, and God describes them as curses that he is bringing on these nations. But you can also see it just in terms of the lack of foresight on the part of the leaders of these nations, that they're so willing to part with these tremendous jewels that God has given them. There's a whole lot more information where that came from. This article, it's an excellent article that is going to appear in this coming edition of the Trumpet Magazine. It's called "Will China Rule the Waves?" We're sending this edition off to the printer this week. And you can look for that in the coming weeks. It should be there up in about a week or so on thetrumpet.com. We'll also include links to some other resources if you want to look more deeply into this very important prophetic trend. Richard, we really appreciate your time in bringing that to us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
As China increases its influence on the seas, America is developing a vulnerability that could severely undermine its own naval power. We'll learn about how in this report from Andrew Miller.
America's merchant marine fleet is almost dead. A chronic lack of merchant vessels may leave the United States unable to supply and sustain a long-distance war. The United States Navy is still the most powerful navy in the world, but America's merchant fleet has become pitifully weak. At the beginning of 2017, the U.S. publicly and privately owned just 2,021 deep-water vessels. Yet 96% of these vessels were registered in nations like Liberia, Panama, and the Marshall Islands. They fly foreign flags, and they are manned by multinational crews. Only 81 of America's merchant ships actually fly the U.S. flag. These ships are manned by sailors who have taken an oath of allegiance to the United States, and collectively, they're called the U.S. Merchant Marine Fleet. As more U.S. companies try to avoid taxes and cut labor costs by registering their ships in foreign nations, the Merchant Marine Fleet has dwindled from 1,288 deepwater vessels in 1951 to only 81 vessels today. This is a serious problem. The merchant marine is a fleet that carries cargo during peacetime, but becomes an auxiliary of the Defense Department during wartime. The Navy itself does not have enough ships to handle a large-scale supply mission in faraway nations. so it relies on the merchant marine fleet to deliver troops and supplies to foreign conflict zones in times of war. During the 1991 Gulf War mobilization, the U.S. military actually had to rely on foreign-flagged ships to send military supplies to the Middle East. Yet the crews of 13 foreign-flagged vessels rebelled against the U.S. and forced their ships away from the war zone. Air Force General Darren McDew told a Senate panel on April 10th that the reduction in actively traded U.S.-flagged vessels correlates to a decline in the number of qualified merchant mariners, the workforce required to deliver U.S. forces to war. If the fleet continues to lose ships, a lengthy mass deployment on the scale of the Desert Shield, Desert Storm could eventually require U.S. forces to rely on foreign-flagged ships for sustainment. Another maritime official, Mark Busby, who was a retired Navy Rear Admiral, told McClatchy News that foreign crews could even sabotage U.S. equipment and information systems. Or they could simply refuse to deliver U.S. military supplies until America reclaims and reflags its ships. This would delay U.S. military forces in an environment where speed is essential. If a foreign naval power decides to create a naval blockade or a no-go zone at sea, any vessel flying a foreign flag may choose to remain neutral and not carry American cargo through disputed territory. China understands the strategic implications of America's dwindling merchant fleet. That is why 4,973 Chinese deepwater vessels fly the Chinese flag. China's merchant vessels stand ready to support the People's Liberation Army at a moment's notice. While almost 17% of merchant vessels worldwide flew the American flag 50 years ago, less than 0.5% of merchant vessels fly the Stars and Stripes today. Americans take for granted the U.S. Navy's ability to handle any conflict that may arise, but naval ships need supply lines. And Captain Carl Schuster and Dr. Patrick Bratton authored a 2015 report on maritime security, claiming that America's weakness in commercial shipping is the nation's Achilles heel. At one time, the United States and Britain controlled virtually every maritime choke point on the planet. This didn't happen by accident. In his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Herbert W. Armstrong explained that these nations are actually descended from the biblical patriarch Abraham. God promised to give Abraham's descendants controls over the gates of their enemies. A gate is a narrow passage of entrance or exit. When speaking nationally, a sea gate is a narrow choke point like the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, and the Straits of Malacca. God gave America and Britain these commercial gates, and he gave them the commercial and military power to defend them. But God also warned that if America and Britain did not obey him, then not only would these gates be taken away, they would be used against them. The decline of the U.S. merchant marines is a curse on America that is stripping the nation of its ability to defend vital trade routes around the world.
Thanks for that, Andrew. It was remarkable. We were just talking with Richard about the difference, the contrast between the mindset of Chinese leaders who have this long-term view, and they're looking at these sea gates as being, you know, critical for projecting their power, at the same time that you have this very short-sighted view on the part of American leaders. And when you're talking about the number of ships that America had at one time, I think you said it was 1,500 ships or 1,200 ships that they had at one time, merchant marine ships, down to 81 today, at the same time that China's has risen to nearly 5,000 vessels. You see that kind of thinking at play for sure.
Right, because we have fewer merchant marine vessels now than any time since the Spanish-American War. And there was a big buildup back during that time. America was thinking more strategically, kind of like China does today. President Theodore Roosevelt learned that lesson firsthand when America didn't have enough merchant marines to get the men he wanted into Cuba during the Spanish-American War. We sent 16,000 soldiers to Cuba during that war, not because that's all we had. That's just all we had the boats for. And so when he was president, he really presided over a big expansion of the U.S. Navy, expansion of the U.S. Merchant Marine, until it really hit its the Merchant Marines hit like its glory days during World War II. And then right after World War II, like I mentioned, like 17% of every ocean-going ship was flying a U.S. flag. We had almost 1,300 merchant vessels. But since then, the strategy has been less about, well, what do we need to maintain supply lines, and more about, like, well, how do we avoid taxes, or how do we cut labor costs? It's obviously nations like China and India and the Philippines pay their sailors a lot less. And so even the ships America owns are oftentimes run by Chinese crews or Indian crews or Filipino crews, and are registered in nations like Panama or the Marshall Islands or Liberia, because there's a tax loophole and you're paying your sailors less. And so the companies save a lot of money. But from a national security standpoint, like I mentioned, Panama
really makes you vulnerable.
Panama's is more reliant on the Chinese economy than they are on the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if there's a war between, say, the U.S. China over Taiwan or some other place in the South China Sea, you can say, like, well, U.S. Navy is stronger than Chinese Navy, but like, oh, but if that war takes any period of time, you need gasoline, you need food, you need ammunition and stuff taken across the seas that you normally rely on the merchant marines to do that. Mm-hmm. And if all your ships are flying a Panamanian flag and being crewed by Chinese sailors, the Panamanians and the Chinese may not be eager and willing to help in a conflict like that.
Right. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. I just was not aware of just how important merchant marines are in wartime, and how much the United States has historically relied on them for those supply lines. You know, as we've been talking about this, I've just been reminded of that incident that happened. Jeremiah Jacques wrote an article about it, about how China actually used its fishermen to take over the Scarborough Shoal in the Philippines, and establishing that strategic triangle there in the South China Sea. That it was a fishing vessel, and, you know, by all outward appearances, civilians were just, they just wanted to fish, but the actual outcome of the incident was that China actually took that area over. And he just talked about how much those civilian vessels of China do operate as a kind of additional wing of their Navy. So when you're looking at the contrast in numbers, you know, 4,900 vessels of China that amplify the power of the Chinese Navy versus 81 of the United States. It's quite a picture.
Right. And I've seen other reports that China actually has 172,000 ships, if you count fishing vessels and everything. I mentioned like the 5,000 or so big ocean-going ones earlier.
Yeah.
But the government definitely has codes and stuff like that all of those ships need to be up to inspection to be ready for military use if needed. And so when you... sometimes a lot of reports you see like U.S. Navy versus Chinese Navy compared, and the U.S. Navy's pretty superior. But when you take a step back and look at like, okay, well, what about U.S. ships versus Chinese ships? Then that gap narrows substantially when you realize that they're all of their merchant ships are ready to support the People's Liberation Army. Where most of America's merchant ships, like I said, they're aren't even registered in America. They're in some Caribbean nation, being manned by a foreign crew, to be able to try to cut those transportation costs as low as possible.
It's a fascinating story. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about America's merchant marines. He's written an article about this. America's Merchant Marine Fleet is Almost Dead. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. Go check it out. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Darkness is descending on the long, historically extraordinary Anglo-American age. Britain, once a globe-girding empire, is certain to struggle on its own after decades of being bullied by a growing European superstate. America, which was once the greatest superpower on Earth, is battered and it's losing its global influence. History teaches that world orders don't last. They come and go. This present one is giving way to something very different, and it truly will be the world's loss. However, Britain and America's brightest days are not history. Glowing within their remarkable past is the promise of a far more luminous future. The British and the Americans have long believed that they were duty-bound, even destined, to lead the world. Kirk Emmert wrote in his book Winston S. Churchill on Empire, "The glory of the British Empire was its service to a cause that transcended Britain, that transcended history, that transcended time itself. And that cause was to lift human life away from barbarism and savagery towards civilization and human excellence." Churchill passionately devoted himself to promoting that empire. He considered the fostering of civilization as its highest purpose. He wrote that empire civilizes both the ruled and their rulers. The United States founders sought to establish a lasting beacon of liberty and democracy to the nations. Lyman Beecher said that the nation was destined to lead the way in the moral and political emancipation of the world. Abraham Lincoln said that America must ensure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. And ever since America entered World War II, it has essentially served as the guarantor of peace in the world. Now, naturally, all such human efforts are imperfect, but really, until recently, the fruits of the Anglo-American effort to benefit mankind have been more sweet than bitter. The prophecies of the Bible reveal that there's an awesome reason for this, and it's one that points back to ancient history, and yet it also illuminates an inspiring future. You can read about it in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. We'd be happy to send you a free copy. The reason is that these nations are the modern descendants of ancient Israel. The Bible shows that Israel was given a tremendous responsibility. God chose this nation to represent him and to set an example for the rest of the world. Biblical history and prophecy show that God still intends for Israel's descendants to fulfill this glorious purpose. When John Winthrop spoke of America as a city on a hill in 1630, he issued this warning: "We must consider that we will be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." Now, really, this is where Britain and America find themselves today. And it's going to get worse. The sun is setting on Anglo-American dominance. And when these nations fall, the world will plunge back into the blackness of barbarism and savagery. But the Bible that prophesied this fall also tells us that Britain and America's brightest days are yet to come. Jeremiah 33 depicts a time yet future, after America and Britain have endured a nightmarish tribulation that is intended to correct them for their sins. And it contains God's promises to restore to them fantastic prosperity and to make them a positive example. They will become, it says, a praise and an honor before all the nations of the earth. God is promising not only to restore these nations to fantastic prosperity, but also to help them become the positive example that they have always struggled and failed to be. But it won't be Pax Americana or the British Empire that these peoples will be promoting. It'll be the peace of God and the kingdom of God. The King of Kings will lift all human life towards civilization and excellence. And Britain and America finally will submit to him, and they'll become the beautiful, godly nations that they were always intended to be. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Francois de Rochefoucauld. If we had no faults of our own, we would not take so much pleasure in noticing those of others. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.